Welcome to Inside the Guard. I am your host, TP Grant, and I am fired up to be here today. We are coming off an awesome UFC 184 card in which Ronda Rousey defended her women's bantamweight title in what was the fastest submission in UFC history, except for one submission back in the SCG era, in which Olev Tektarov faced Anthony Macias, who was managed by the same, had the same manager, and it was a tournament mount, so he dove right into a guillotine that was finished within 9 seconds, and it's universally considered to be a work. I believe it's confirmed that they worked out something ahead of time so Oleg would move on, so that makes Ronda Rousey's 14-second armbar of Kat Zingano pretty much, I mean, the fastest legitimate submission we've ever seen in the UFC, and it was just flat-out phenomenal. I'm your host, TP Grant. You can follow me on Twitter at @TP_Grant. You can find my writing on bloodyelbow.com. I did a really, really quick write-up of the armbar the night of a judo chop breakdown. And you can go have a look at that, but I'm just going to skip right to it because this was an awesome display of transitional grappling. So we're just diving right in an in-depth look of that armbar because it was nothing short of awesome. So one of the main points heading into this fight was the idea that Kat Zingano was a slow starter, and it seems like she wanted to try to force a quick start, so she bull-rushed Ronda with that flying knee. And Zingano's game is very similar to Ronda. She likes to be in close. She likes to work from the clinch, use strikes to set up powerful throws. They're very, very similar. So Zingano decided to go. It looks like she decided to go strength on strength and see who was better in the clinch. So right now up is an image of the flying knee. And you can see pretty clearly that Ronda has successfully sidestepped the knee. You can see that Zingano didn't actually make contact. And right now, Rousey's actually on a pretty good angle to Zingano. She's kind of looking at Zingano while Zingano's looking straight ahead, which isn't a great position to be in necessarily. It actually would suggest that Ronda's in the more dominant position for the takedown, but Zingano recovers very, very quickly. And she's able to, as you can see in this next image, turn, and she's able to actually kind of shoot an underhook on Ronda. And she gets this position where she is in something close to like a half hip throw position, where she's at like a T to Ronda, like she and Ronda are making a T, where the Zingano's the stem and then Ronda's the top of the T. And Zingano drops straight to her knees and attempts to just kind of bulldog Ronda over. And that's where the sequence really, really gets started. And it's here that we're going to kind of take a step back out of the second by second and take a broader view of Ronda's judo background, because it becomes highly relevant in this moment. And judo is, at its essence, a throwing martial art. It is focused on the techniques, principles, and science of taking a resisting human being off balance and then throwing them to the ground with some authority and hitting them with the planet Earth. And the very first thing a judo white belt learns how to do is how to fall properly. It's commonly known as break falling. And this skill is almost universal to martial arts. How to fall without injuring yourself is a self-defense must. And, I mean, it's simple self-preservation, especially for those of us that have to walk dogs in icy conditions. And the basic idea of a break fall is you're going to spread out the impact. You want to give that, the force of you hitting the ground, you want to give as much surface area to that force as you can. So when you come down, you try to land flat on your back if you can, or if you're going to do a side break fall, you land on your side, but you slap your arm out and you kind of slap the mat or the ground to kind of disperse that impact. And you'll see, this is how stuntmen fall. If you've ever seen like stunt falls where they like dive off buildings and they always land on their backs with their arms outstretched under those big giant air cushions. That is designed to spread the impact out. It's a very safe way to fall. If you post an arm, it's very easy for you to break your arm if you don't know what you're doing. Your chin is tucked so you don't whiplash your head into the mat and, you know, disorient yourself or, you know, give yourself a concussion. If at all possible, you rock with it a little bit, again, to kind of disperse some of that inertia, kind of like in car crashes, how the car crashes in like NASCAR and other racing sports, when the car goes end over end, the driver always is almost always able to walk away because that energy of the crash is spent in the spinning end over end. The ones where guys really get hurt are where the car just goes right into the wall and stops because all that energy gets transferred into the driver when there's just that sudden stop. When you have that ability to kind of rock with it, you kind of disperse that energy in it. You're much less likely to get hurt. And so that's all well and good. But let's say you're in judo and now you want to compete, and suddenly things change a bit because in judo competition, you win when you're awarded an ippon, and that's a total victory point. And you can earn an ippon by getting a pin, a submission, or a perfect throw. You can also get lesser throws that add up to an ippon, but that's not really important right now. And a perfect throw, an ippon throw, places their opponent on their back with control and power. So if you're in a judo competition and someone throws you and you do a classic breakfall, you basically landed in the exact fashion that is sure to result in an ippon for your opponent and a loss. And for those of you who have been watching the video, I've had a little running video of judo ippon, a highlight of ippons from 2014, and you can see several of the images. Some of them are submissions, some of them are pins, but you can see some of the throws in which guys are landing flat on their back, or their back is kind of landing flush to the mat at any point, is considered to be an ippon, and the match is over. It's like a submission or a knockout, or things like that. So judoka are very, very good at getting these throws, but also you have to be good at not being thrown like this. Now, this idea that you don't want to be thrown to your back is a problem shared by wrestlers and sambists, because landing flat on your back in a throw in those sports, while a safe way to fall, is bad from a scoring perspective. So within the context of these competitive throwing arts, a style of falling has become favored that's generally referred to as a turnout. And for an international level judo competitor like Ronda, it's a vital skill. Because if you're competing in high level sambo, high level judo, or high level wrestling, it doesn't matter who you are. There are so many matches, so many tournaments that are filled with really good athletes and grapplers, you're gonna get thrown. And you don't want being thrown once to be you've lost and you're out. You need to have some sort of a defense. So a throw is basically a transition. It's going from a standing position to a grounded position. And guys are becoming more comfortable in this transition. Or I should say guys and girls in general have become more and more comfortable in this transition. And the turnout is essentially falling in a fashion in which you will not land flat on your back. And I have some examples going right now. Now, the principle is pretty simple. Instead of fighting the throw, you ride the momentum of the throw. In the ideal case, the perfect case that you're seeing like right now, you ride it into a full cartwheel out of the throw, and you land back on your feet ready to grapple. At the very least, you ride it to the point of being able to turn over and belly out and land on your stomach, which is not as valuable in the scoring from the scoring perspective of those sports as throwing someone to their back. Judoka Grigori Zantaria is well known for his ability to avoid landing on his back. He's very adept at bellying out in throws, and in the right situations, he can cartwheel you out of throws or even hit a full reversal midair and score an ippon for himself. And right now, I have some images of him teaching some of these techniques, and you can just, I mean, number one, it shows that yes, people are training this. This is something that is a learned skill. It takes athleticism. You have to be a pretty good, it's a dynamic movement. You know, if you're not quite strong enough to do a headstand while you do this, well, then you got to get in the gym and work on that. But this is also the result of hours and hours of drilling. This is a learned skill. It's not something that's intuitive to being an athlete. Because Ronda was able to do it, but Kat Zingano is an excellent athlete, and she was not really able to do it at all. So when Ronda gets thrown, she doesn't have a hand free to post on, so she uses her head, literally. She does a headstand and uses that cartwheel to cartwheel through to her stomach. Right now, I have a couple examples of Grigori doing this maneuver, but let's switch over and take a look at the still images of Ronda hitting it. So here you see Ronda on her head, mid-cartwheel, And at this point, Zingano has dropped to her knees, but the momentum of the throw isn't over for her either. The transition is still occurring. Zingano's weight is carrying her forward at this point because she dropped forward, and she was expecting everything to come to a dead stop when Ronda's back hit the mat, and then she would be in a good position, and you know, we would see Ronda on her back in a, you know, a dominant, in the bottom side of a dominant position for, I think, the first time in her career. So when Ronda continued to roll and continued the momentum, Zingano had nothing to base out with and was kind of brought along for the ride in kind of a counter-Ippon sort of move that, I mean, has just been burned into Ronda's muscle memory from all the years of judo she's done, and what I'm assuming are, like, quite literally thousands of hours of drilling throws and throw counters in the lead-up to her Olympic career. So Zingano is rolled over, and she also tries to kind of belly out and turn out and end up on her stomach. The problem here is that this is a reaction that Ronda is really used to. This is her wheelhouse. This is judo-like transitioning. She has just countered someone's hip throw, and that person is now bellied out in an effort to avoid being pinned. This is what she's been doing her entire life. So Ronda immediately knows what she's going to do. She steps over, as you can see here, and she's going to take what is basically the back mount at this point, the belly down back mount. Zingano's face is down in the mat. Ronda's coming up on top of her, and this is a very, very bad position, especially when strikes are involved. And they end up in this position right here. The picture's a bit blurry, but basically, Zingano is still kind of, her hips are facing down, but her upper body, her shoulders are kind of turned away from Ronda at this point. And it appears that Ronda has hooked her right arm around Kat Zingano's left arm, which is on the bottom here, while Zingano's right arm, which is kind of on top, is hooked around Ronda's head. And a lot of people have been critical of Zingano for grabbing Rousey's head in this situation, exposing her arm. But from this angle, it seems pretty darn clear both of Zingano's arms are in danger here from arm bars. Rousey has hit this transition perfectly. If Zingano were to pull her arm, her right arm down and try to get that arm out of danger from around Ronda's head, all Ronda would have to do is pull up on Zingano's left arm and step over and do a classic spinning arm bar to take the left arm. So it is entirely possible that Zingano either A, got completely lost in transition and is taking a moment here to figure out what is exactly going on, or B, is so concerned about her left arm that she doesn't consider the danger that her right arm is in. Either or both are entirely possible because of how fast things developed here. Transitions in general, and for those of you that aren't aware, transitions in grappling are, you know, you have the UFC video game. So if any of you play the UFC video game, there are the positions that you can go to, right? There's guard, half guard, there's posture up, there's posture down, there's side control, there's mount. Transitions are going from kind of established positions where kind of both parties have neutral momentum at that point. And when someone or both parties are moving kind of at the same time to kind of improve or change their position. And in transition, hitting things in transition when both parties are kind of moving, when both bodies are moving somewhat independently of each other, is where really high-level grappling takes place. And transitions can make very good grapplers look bad because really what it comes down to is familiarity with a transition. If you are, I mean, like, I mentioned this on Heavy Hands, but a guard pass is a transition, and it's one that jiu-jitsu guys are very, very comfortable with. They've spent thousands of hours in the gym working different guard passes, you know, getting caught in triangles, getting caught in arm bars, you know, learning the do's and don'ts of those transitions so that it becomes second nature to them and they can do all these things very, very quickly. For Ronda, this sort of transition off of a throw is what she's been doing her whole life. For Kat Zingano, it's not necessarily the most, like, intuitive thing. And you have good grapplers who make bad mistakes in transitions they're not familiar with. So it's entirely possible here that Zingano got a little bit lost in the transition while Ronda was, you know, just reacting while Zingano was thinking. So at this point, Ronda just has to pick an arm and she decides to go for Zingano's right arm. So Ronda takes her right arm and kind of does like a backstroke maneuver and puts it on Zingano's back. And now her armpit, Ronda's armpit, is grabbing Zingano's right arm. And Ronda's left arm posts out far on the mat, and she transfers her weight to that arm. Now, in this position, Zingano's pretty much done. Her only real defense would be to try to turn into Ronda and, like, drive her elbow to the floor, and even then, it would likely just have resulted in the exact same armbar occurring, just Ronda looking up at the ceiling and Zingano looking up in the ceiling rather than the position they ended up in. Now, Ronda's going to transfer all of her weight to that posted arm on the mat, and she's going to use that to lighten her left leg. She's going to bring her left leg out, and she's going to bring it across Zingano's face. And she actually ends up hooking Zingano's other arm in this transition and just, like, stretching Zingano out horribly. But she ends up in this armbar that we drill it sometimes at my school as a headlock escape, and it's just brutal. The amount of pressure you can bring on the arm with this kind of the armpit trap that you're seeing here. Now Ronda has sat to face Zingano's legs. She's got her her armpit grabbing Zingano's wrists and the elbows right on the hips. Ronda just kind of pinches her elbow to her body and pushes her hips forward. The pressure on this is very intense. The elbow goes very, very quickly in this position. There's very, very little force required from Ronda to finish this armbar, which is why you got such frantic tapping from Zingano in this position. It was just a masterful display of transitional grappling from Ronda Rousey. And, I mean, it was textbook judo transition. It was a throw. It was a counter to the throw. In the resulting scramble, she took up in the arm. It was all extraordinarily quick. It all was kind of one fluid motion. Ronda, even in a judo tournament where they stop things very, very quickly, Ronda would have likely been able to work this entire sequence because she was working the entire time. She was attacking the entire time. This is exactly what I talked about when we were talking on Heavy Hands earlier this week, which, by the way, if you don't listen to Heavy Hands, it's a fantastic podcast. Go find it after you get done listening to the show. The idea of sprint grappling in MMA. This is like a textbook example. As soon as the throw is initiated, Ronda does not stop working until she has an armbar in place. It was absolutely phenomenal. All right, so I suppose there were other fights on the card that we should talk about, and the co-main event leads naturally into the next question that you're going to get with Ronda Rousey, and that's who she should fight next. Now, of course, the number one thing that comes up, or the number one person that should be mentioned, is Cyborg. And I really have my reservations about this fight happening for a couple of reasons, though the biggest reason is there's really not that much in it for Ronda. They would have to throw a ton of money at Ronda to make this happen, because there's zero value in her going up in weight. Like, do a catchweight bout in 140. It's not for a belt. It's not for anything special for Ronda. It would have to be for a lot of money. Going up to 145 is utterly, I mean, pointless. There's not as nearly as deep of a division there as there at 135. There's significantly more talent at 135 than there is at 145 for Ronda to beat up on. And the risk for Ronda is incredibly high. I mean, it will cast a huge shadow over her if she gets run out of the building by Cyborg. And for the record, I don't think she does. I think this fight was a pretty solid example of just because you're strong in the clinch, just because you're powerful in the clinch, doesn't mean you have the depth of technique to hang with a bronze medalist in judo who's adapted her game perfectly for MMA just because you've suplexed a couple people at times. And I'm not saying Cyborg's a bad fighter. She's a really good fighter. She is one of the best women's fighters. But it just gets to the point where it's talking about, like, are we talking about the fact that, you know, if Chris Weidman starts beating up his whole division, are we demanding that John Jones go down there and teach this middleweight a lesson? It smacks to me more of the reaction to Ronda than anything else. The people just want to see Ronda get her ass kicked. more than it making sense from a sport perspective. Ronda's fine where she is. She's going to make a ton of money fighting whoever she fights at this point. She's a huge event. The ball is in Cyborg's court to get down to 135, and I don't think that happens safely or in a way that kind of keeps Cyborg as a competitive fighter. And it sucks for Cyborg. She's in a rough spot. But she's also failed. She's also failed a drug test. She's also, I mean, that's another factor, is how willing will the UFC be to bring in someone who has a history of PED use and put them in against one of their, like, you know, golden draws at this point. I know Rousey doesn't exactly break the bank pay-per-view number wise, but she's on par with some of the other male champions. And just so much crossover with her that doesn't show up in things like pay-per-view numbers that make her very valuable, and put her up against someone with a known PED history and have a fight that could easily fall apart from a pre-fight drug test or something like that. I feel like there's a lot of risk involved. The UFC will only make it if it's an absolute necessity. One of the people that could potentially be fighting Ronda in the future is Holly Holm, and Holly Holm had a less than thrilling debut against Raquel Pennington in the co-main event, and it was something that if you followed me on Twitter or other things that I was, or you watched MMA Prospectus, I fully expected Holm to struggle in this fight. Pennington is a very tough inside fighter. Holm, for all the talk that her professional boxing career gets, her punches are not that, like, technically sound. She doesn't get a lot of power into them. It's really her kicks that are, like, the centerpiece of her offense, and her kind of step left knee is really, really good, and she's not the best at controlling distance. She's a pretty good grappler, and she stuffed a lot of Pennington's takedowns. She had a pretty nice ability to swim for an underhook and kind of get her hips out so she didn't have to do, like, a full sprawl. So that was all good, but it wasn't a super impressive performance because that's not Holly Holm. She's not this, like, you know, incredible knock-you-out, put-you-away, one-hitter-quitter striker that people have kind of made her out to be. She's going to do better than she did in this fight. I think there was a combination of making your UFC debut and facing someone who's just a really bad stylistic matchup for you. But there's also something to be said for the fact that the best fighters at 135 are almost all clinch fighters, and that's where Holly struggled the most. So I don't think Holly Holm is a big-time threat to Ronda Rousey. I do think that there will be interest in that fight if and when it occurs. So I'm not super surprised. Raquel Pennington put up a heck of a fight. Pennington doesn't have the most impressive record in the world, but she's a really good, tough fighter. She absolutely deserves to stick around in the UFC. She can do some good things for them and is a pretty solid gatekeeper type. Let's take a little jump down the card a little bit further and talk Jake Ellenberger and Josh Koscheck, because holy smokes, was that a violent, violent choke. Jake Ellenberger, you know, he was exchanging strikes with Josh Koscheck, trying to find a home for his signature right hand. Josh Koscheck was shaking it off like, you know, no big deal when it connected. And they ended up with Josh Ellenberger getting kind of the power guillotine. And the power guillotine, I mean, the guillotine in general, we talked about this with the North-South choke. The guillotine is really, you know, it works on the same principle as a rear naked choke, and he was able to shoot his grip in deep enough to get the full, like, rear naked choke grip from the front. And Koscheck did pretty much the only thing you can do in that situation, and he tried to spin out of it, and he dropped to the ground. And Ellenberger put in what appeared to be a no-gi Ezekiel choke. And for those of you that aren't aware, like, an Ezekiel choke is I dive my arm around the back of your head, and then if I have a gi, I grab my own sleeve of my other hand and I bring it in front of your neck, so my one arm is behind your head and my other arm, it comes in front of your neck, and then if I can, I grab my forearm and then I straighten my arms and I take away all that space, and it's just it's a nasty choke. And you can do it in no gi, and in no gi it's even meaner, because when you grab your forearm, you usually just drive your fist into their neck, and that appeared to be what was happening. And I mean, Josh Koscheck's reaction to that was that of someone being strangled. He was kicking around, flopping around, trying to get out. And then, of course, that camera angle that showed him foaming at the mouth with, like, pure panic in his eyes was... And even further down the card, we had some slick back taken going on as both Ronan Carnero and Tony Ferguson sunk really slick rear naked chokes, but between the two of them, Tony Ferguson choking out Gleison Tibau in just under 3 minutes, that's pretty legitimate stuff. That's an impressive performance. And I think it's pretty clear that, I mean, in his UFC run, the only guy that Tony Ferguson has lost to has been Michael Johnson, who it's pretty well proven at this point. Michael Johnson's a damn good fighter. I think Tony Ferguson is really sneaking up on people. He's clearly, at this point, a really good fighter that deserves some serious credit from fans. And I think he needs to start getting considerate. He needs to start getting top 15 opponents at this point. I mean, that's the kind of guy that's going to challenge Tony Ferguson at this point, because he's just absolutely putting dudes away. The only other thing I'm going to talk about today is the eye poke that ended the Kid Yamamoto Roman Salazar fight. And if you've ever read my Sunday Perspective work, which I've ended to pursue this particular podcast, for the better, I think. You guys don't need to be reading my 1 a.m. typos on Sunday mornings anymore. This fight, you know, eye pokes I've been very vocal on. You have to start taking a point regardless if it's an accident or not, even if you don't think it's intentional, because the only way this is going to get fixed is if the athletes themselves are conscious on whether or not they're extending their hands with their fingers open or with their fingers closed. It's the only way it's going to happen. You have to make the penalty severe enough that the athletes will adjust their behavior to the rules, because as it stands, the athletes don't have to adjust their behavior, and you'll have guys like the aforementioned Josh Koscheck, who will be totally okay with getting an eye poke or two in a fight because, hey, I'm not getting punished for it, and it gives me a little bit of an advantage. So I really feel that that needs to be something that changes. I mean, I don't think gloves, you know, curved gloves are necessarily the answer. I think it could help, but it's not going to get rid of all eye pokes. I think the only way you solve this is by modifying athlete behavior, and I think the only way you do that is by, you know, by penalizing it so heavily that the athletes are the ones who are responsible for not doing it if they want to have a winning career. Well, other than all that, I'm not sure we have too much more meaningful things to take away from this card, because I mean, when we're talking about cards that have been ravaged by injury, this UFC 184 is right up there. It ended up being entertaining. I don't feel my money was misspent in buying that pay-per-view at all, but in terms of high-level, meaningful MMA, we got a couple high points, but there was quite a bit on this card that, you know, I think is going to come up on my MMA Prospectus show. Well, not mine. Myself, Zane Simon, and Patrick Wyman talking about young fighters and things like that. And then there were a couple fights that, you know, I mean, you know, Mark Munoz getting choked out again. I kind of feel like Mark needs to maybe think about moving on and just focusing on coaching. I'm never going to tell a guy to retire, but at this point, the UFC's trying to find dudes for Mark Munoz to be competitive with, and he is consistently not being competitive with them. I think Mark Munoz is pretty clearly past his peak as a fighter and is in a heavy, heavy decline at this point. So I think we're just going to call it and say, what a fantastic card, considering all the crap surrounding it in terms of injuries and things like that. Imagine how amazing it would have been to have Chris Weidman and Vitor Belfort on this card. But, you know, that's MMA, and, you know, we learned a valuable lesson tonight about running directly at Olympic judo medalists. You can find me on Twitter at TP_Grant. Of course, you can find me on Bloody Elbow. I'm over on the subreddit for MMA on Reddit. I'm all over the place. If you ever have any questions or requests or anything for the show, shoot me a tweet, shoot me an email. I will be back doing Inside the Guard for the aftermath of UFC 185 on March 14th. So until then, have a great week.